Hi, my name is Doc Stull, and welcome to New Books in Jazz. The prolific and peripatetic vibe player Cal Jader was a fixture in the San Francisco Bay Area Latin jazz scene for four decades, until Jader's death of a heart attack at the age of only 56 in 1982. Jader, whose father was a vaudevillian and his mother a classical pianist, was a wunderkind tap dancer and was already performing on stage at age four. Jader won a local Gene Krupa drum contest in high school, served in World War II, graduated from San Francisco State, and made early recordings as a drummer with Dave Brubeck and Paul Desmond. But Jader, whom jazz pianist George Shearing called a percussive genius, soon became enamored of Afro-Cuban rhythms. Jader's melodic vibe playing and his collaborations with Willie Bobo, Mongo Santa Maria, Armando Peraza, Pancho Sanchez, and many others helped popularize and revolutionize the small group Latin jazz sound. Here to talk about his new book, Cal Jader, The Life and Recordings of the Man Who Revolutionized Latin Jazz, published by McFarland & Company, Incorporated, 2013, is Duncan Reed. Talking to Duncan Reed, the author of Cal Jader, The Life and Recordings of the Man Who Revolutionized Latin Jazz. It's great to have you with us on New Books in Jazz. As you know, I grew up in the Bay Area, and I was a big Cal Jader fan, and was really happy to read your book because there wasn't a lot out there about him. So tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write this book about Cal Jader.
When I was growing up, my dad had a collection of 78 records. He was a big jazz aficionado. He's from St. Louis, and he saw a lot of jazz artists, you know, that are very well known, like Charlie Parker and Lester Young and Stan Getz, and even befriended some of them casually. He was a painter and sometimes would trade his artwork to them, you know, for various things, you know, performances. And he knew Charlie Ventura, so I was exposed to that as a kid. He would play the 78 records. I wasn't really into it at that time, but I liked what I heard. And then later on, when I was 18, it dawned on me this is really good music. And my mother was the one who was aware of Cal Jader, and that's how I got into it. And that was a little bit later. I was aware of him when I was in my late teens, but he wasn't really on my radar yet as far as listening to the music. That came later, again, from buying records for my mother because she was really into his music. So that's how I got into it.
I don't know that I have ever read such a detailed account of the arc and trajectory of a jazz musician's life. You seem to have every gig and every date and the circumstances surrounding it. How long did it take you to do this?
Well, I started it, I got the idea for it late in 2004, and I began work on it like probably the early work anyway, November 2004. And then in earnest, I started doing more interviews early the following year. Fortunately, my mother was friends with Benny Velarde, who played with Cal in his early Mambo Quintet. And that kind of gave me an inroad there with the interviews. And I also knew a jazz musician named Chuck Medcalf, a jazz bassist, and he gave me some numbers, and then it went on from there. And so that's how I was able to get to talk to people. I was very fortunate that I had, you know, some connections in the jazz world here in the Bay Area. As far as all the gigs and documenting everything, it took a long time. It took me 8 years to write the book. I was working another job at the time, and so I couldn't devote, you know, 100% of my time to it. That's part of the reason. And also, it's my first book, so I kind of was learning as I was going along how you write a biography, and I was reading other people, and it was a learning process. So as far as the gigs, I did the best I could. I didn't, as I say in my preface, I didn't get all of them. I did, you know, it's very difficult, you know, when you go back that far, particularly. But I did look at a lot of old newspapers and magazines, and of course the interviews with all of Cal's former sidemen and colleagues. That was a big help as well.
We talked to one of your colleagues, Derek Bang, in my last interview about another great Bay Area jazz musician, Vince Guaraldi, who of course played with Cal Jader. Yeah. And the book did fill a gap because it's hard for me to believe that Cal Jader hasn't been around, nor Vince Guaraldi, for almost three decades. So it's a good thing that you did the book, because the book convinced me, certainly, that he had a profound effect on the popularity of Latin jazz. And I want you to talk a little bit about that, because the strain throughout the whole book are the people that Cal Jader brought into his fold, and the demographic that he affected on the West Coast in particular, the college audience. And then, of course, his musicianship. Many people commented on in the book what a wonderful, sensitive musician he was. Tell us a little bit about Cal Jader, his early life, and how a Swedish guy became such a percussive genius and became so interested in Latin jazz.
Well, he came from a family of performers. His father was in vaudeville, and his mother was a classically trained pianist when his father met her. And she was thinking of becoming a concert pianist, in fact. But after he married her, the father, Callan Sr., brought his mother, Victoria, into the world of vaudeville. She would play the piano. He was a dancer and an actor. And Cal was in an environment of performers early on. And from the age of two, he was, you know, beginning to be trained by his father to be a dancer. So Cal said himself in interviews that it was that early training as a dancer that helped him develop his natural sense of rhythm, which of course led to his, you know, being very successful as a musician. He was put into the act, actually. They were a traveling vaudeville troupe, and that's how Cal was born in St. Louis, because both of his parents were living in San Francisco at the time. And they went on a tour, and Cal was born in St. Louis, and they remained there for a couple of years. I guess they were doing a circuit in that area and just stayed. And then they came back to the Bay Area, and at the age of four, Cal made his debut as a tap dancer. So that's how he got his early exposure. And he also was trained by his mother on the piano, and he didn't like that so much because she would use a ruler. If he didn't want to do it, she would whack him with the ruler. He wanted to be out playing softball with his friends. But, you know, later he admitted that, you know, he was glad that he had that training. And he had an experience when he was an adolescent where he would perform with his mother. He would tap dance, and she would play the piano, and they would do these recitals it's at various places, little theaters. And in fact, they had a little theater at their house because they had a tap dancing studio in San Mateo, both of his parents. And they would teach ballroom dance as well. But Cal would do these recitals with his mother, and he did one at San Mateo High when he first got there. And he was in a sailor's outfit, and everybody in the audience, which is made up of adolescents, a lot of boys, they booed him and hissed at him and called him a sissy. And he was humiliated. He left the stage. After that, he just put his shoes in the closet, and his parents couldn't talk him out of it. His father was gone by that time. He had a stepfather, Keith Evans, who was also a musician. He was a piano player, but they couldn't talk him out of it. But that led to his getting into music. He took up the drums after that by listening to Gene Krupa albums and various other, you know, Benny Goodman and various other big bands at the time. So he really taught himself. That was his early entry into music.
That whole idea of him teaching himself, that's kind of a strain throughout the book, too, that he would...
Yes.
Would come up against these guys, Peraza and Mongo Santa Maria and people like that, and he was like a sponge. He would study them and pick up their rhythmic patterns, and that seemed to be he was doing that his whole career, wasn't he?
Yes, Dave Brubeck said that Cal was one of the most natural musicians he ever knew, and. Yeah, Cal just seemed to have a natural facility for it. Yeah, I mean, some people can work and study very hard all their life and become decent musicians, but they don't get on that level that Cal was on. Where they're just naturally attuned to the music and they just play in an incredibly nuanced style and they just have an ear for what sounds good. They're able to put it together. And that's what a lot of his, you know, people that were involved with him, you know, noticed was he just knew how to make things sound good. He knew how to put things together so that it would appeal to people. And also it was a great artistic achievement for himself at the same time. But he got his start with Dave Brubeck. As I noted in the book, even prior to that, though, he was playing in Dixieland bands with Merv Griffin. Some people may not know that, but he grew up with Merv Griffin from elementary school. So they went to St. Matthew's, which was a Catholic school. And they played in Dixieland bands. Merv played the piano. Cal would play the drums. And he did that for a while. And then after he got out of the war, World War II, he was in the Navy. He actually did a gig when he was in the Navy at an officer's club. He played the drums. And then after he got out, he went to San Jose State and then eventually transferred to San Francisco State. At San Jose State, he had his only formal training in music. He took lessons from Walter LaRue, who was worked for the San Francisco Symphony at the time. He was the lead timpanist. And Cal took lessons from him, but those were his only formal lessons. And eventually he joined Dave Brubeck's octet, that experimental octet. And then Brubeck, that group didn't get a lot of gigs because of the experimental nature of the band. A lot of people were not attuned to their sound. And so they, you know, Brubeck would reform it and break it up and so forth, you know, depending on, you know, how things were. And he eventually formed a split-off group, a trio, with Ron Crotty, bass player, and Cal on drums. And that's how Cal really got his first exposure. And he took up the Vibes just prior to joining Dave Brubeck. As I note in the book, Lionel Hampton... invited him to sit in one night on drums. He wanted a second drummer, and he invited him, you know, into the band. But Cal said that he wanted to make use of his GI Bill and get his education, so he didn't go on tour with Hampton. But he did start again studying the Vibes on his own, and he debuted them with Dave Brubeck. So he was playing the Vibes and the drums with Dave Brubeck, and then, as I note in the book, there's a pivotal moment where they're playing at a club called Ciro's, which was on Geary Street in San Francisco, and Armando Peraza, who happened to be in town because he was in Slim Gaylord's band. Slim Gaylord came into town and then did a gig there, didn't pay Peraza, and then left. And so Peraza was penniless and sweeping the floors of this club. The club owner took pity on him, let him sleep there. And one day he said to Dave Brubeck, he said, "This kid can really play bongos and conga drums. Did you let him sit in?" So he did. And Cal was there and was just immediately taken with the rhythms that Peraza was producing. Paul Desmond and Dick Collins were also there, so it was like a quintet. Brubeck had a quintet, and as according to Brubeck, Cal took lessons, you know, informally with Peraza, and that he just really became enamored of, you know, the Cuban sound and wanted to integrate it into the group. A lot of people don't know that, but that's when Cal's interest first started, and that was, you know, here in San Francisco.
So that was San Francisco. What year was that, Duncan?
That was early in 1950. I'm not sure the exact date, but, you know, maybe early March, but definitely early in the year.
Okay. So, and that was interesting to me because, you know, San Francisco was kind of known for the Dixieland revival bands
right.
that were going, and Oakland was kind of
right.
known for maybe the blues. But
yeah.
the Brubeck connection and the kind of they you know they call it West Coast jazz and there's all kinds of implications you know and people read into that but it was a different
right.
kind of jazz wasn't it than what was going on the East Coast with people like Tito Puente and people like that it's very
well,
different
yeah it was different Tito Puente had an orchestra. So he had a really big sound. You know, he had a full horn section, a full percussion section with timbales, you know, bongos, congas. And so it was a really big sound. And Cal didn't get exposed to that initially. His first exposure to a group with that sound, the mambo sound that was popular at the time, was Perez Prado, who was from Cuba, and his initial success was in Mexico. And so when he first toured the United States, which was, I believe, was 1950-51, Cal did go to see him and was aware of him. So that was his first exposure to that. And then, of course, you know, right around the same time, probably a little before that, he met Peraza and then was exposed to Perez Prado, but it was, you could see the very early influence of Cal's interest in the Cuban sound in a recording he did with the Dave Brubeck trio called Perfidia. If you listen to that, you'll notice that Brubeck is playing in the Cuban style and that Ron Crotty has a nice groove going and Cal is playing the bongos on there. And so if you listen to that, that's the very earliest example I know of a small group, particularly a group of that size, you know, a jazz group incorporating, you know, the Cuban influence. So, and then when Cal left Brubeck after he had a swimming accident in Hawaii, and Brubeck was in the hospital in Honolulu, Cal was offered a contract by Max Weiss at Fantasy Records, and he said, why don't you make your own trio? You and Jack Weeks, who was the bass player at the time, he had replaced Ron Crotty, who had to go to the war in Korea. So they came back. They only waited like maybe a few days as Brubeck was recuperating, and they told Dave that they were going to split and come back to San Francisco, and Cal put together his own trio. With Jack Weeks on bass, and initially John Marabuto on piano for the first several months, and then Vince Guaraldi. In the fall of 1951 is when Guaraldi joined. And you can see in his early recordings that influence. He did a song called Chopsticks Mambo, which, you know, the old piano lesson ditty that we've all heard. Din, 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 din. But he did it very differently. It's really interesting the way, you know, he put that arrangement together. And both Weeks and Guaraldi seem to be really on the same page with him when you listen to the song. And he also arranged Hoagy Carmichael's Ivy to have a little kind of a Latin tinge to it. And he plays the bongos on that. And it's interesting, on Chopsticks Mambo, he also plays the cowbell and the bongos at the same time, like when Guaraldi is soloing. So that's a real early example of what Cal was doing. Yeah, it's a real early example of how Cal was pioneering that influence in the small group sound. you didn't really hear any jazz groups of that size, certainly, Trio's doing what he was doing.
The other thing you mentioned, too, was that this kind of connection with Brubeck and the influence in playing on college campuses, that you were actually bringing a different demographic into
right.
the appreciation of jazz. So you had the small group thing, which was different for the Latin sound. But then because they were touring and they were playing on college campuses, you had a whole different demographic coming in. And of course, jazz clubs in San Francisco between what after World War II and through the 50s, it was kind of a golden era, wasn't it? So people were going to jazz clubs.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There were quite a few that were, you know, particularly in North Beach along Broadway, you know, various clubs popped up, like you mentioned in the post-war years, particularly in the 50s is when they started coming out. The most famous of which, of course, is the Blackhawk, which was Cal's home club for many years. He first played there with Dave Brubeck. In fact, Brubeck was the first jazz musician to play at the Blackhawk. And Cal was in his group at that time. Yeah, and yeah, Brubeck, I think, with his recitals at Mills College when he first formed the octet, and then his, you know, playing at the College of the Pacific in Stockton, and being really interested in taking jazz to college students in listening concerts. Jazz musicians had played swing dances and things like that at colleges, but for people to sit down and listen to jazz, I think Brubeck was really a pioneer in that area. And Cal certainly, after he became a leader, picked up on that, and he really enjoyed playing for a college audience. He liked their enthusiasm. They accepted what he offered and were really enthusiastic about his playing ballads, which he said was not always the case when he was in a jazz club. So, and then afterwards, he really enjoyed talking to them and their youthful energy and the exposure, you know, that they were getting to what he was doing, and also his exposure to their, you know, their enthusiasm for jazz.
I don't remember if you mentioned this in the book, Duncan, but when you were talking about that, I was raised in the era of, you know, the Young People's Concerts with Lenny Bernstein, who was a big fan of jazz, of course. Going on too when they were on the college campuses? Were they educating at the same time or talking about the compositions as well? You mentioned, of course, that, you know, jazz as listening was kind of a different phenomenon.
Cal talked about it informally. Like, for instance, after a concert, he would talk to the faculty members who also were interested and in what he was doing. And the students would come up and ask him questions. It wasn't so much like there was a formal class or anything, but they were just very interested in what he was doing. And he was happy to talk to them. Cal was always very accessible to people. He was not somebody who had a big head and, you know, was aloof. He was very approachable. So it was more on an informal basis, really.
Yeah, I don't know if you use the word ambassador, but that you really got that feeling. I mean, I got that feeling when I heard him play and relate to audiences that he was just really a great jazz ambassador, because he was just such a pleasant, upbeat guy. And I think he really turned a lot of people on to jazz, you know, not only because of his musicianship, but just because he had that personality, that kind of warm, ebullient personality that made you feel good. Yeah, it really made you feel good when you heard his music. Talk about the Monterey Jazz Festival and the relationship with Jader and the Monterey Jazz Festival, and in terms of exposure.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting story, because Cal, of course, knew Jimmy Lyons, who co-founded the Monterey Jazz Festival with Ralph Gleason, the noted Chronicle columnist and Downbeat writer. And Cal knew Jimmy Lyons way back when they had the Dave Brubeck Octet, because he was a big, big proponent of Dave Brubeck's music. And he had a jazz show called Lyons Busy, way back in those days, which was like 1948, 49, 50. And so he was really promoting the local jazz scene. And then after he founded the Monterey Jazz Festival, he and Cal were already very good friends. And he naturally wanted to bring Cal in on the ground floor. So in 1958, when he was proposing the idea of having a jazz festival in Monterey, he actually had Cal do the first preview concert for that. So the festival hadn't even started in 58, and Cal did a preview concert in July. I don't know too many of the details, but I do know that it took place. And then, of course, later in the fall, in October, Cal participated in the first Monterey Jazz Festival, which I believe was October 3rd and 4th, 1958. And Cal was supposed to perform several times, but because they had so many acts and things ran over and the scheduling didn't work out quite as well as they had hoped. But Cal did end up coming on, I think it was on a Saturday at 1 a.m. And actually he came on, I think, just after midnight and played till 1 a.m. And Buddy DeFranco, the very great clarinetist, who's still around, by the way, and he sat in with Cal, and they did a wonderful jazz concert, which featured an extended versions of Summertime and Charlie Parker's Now's the Time. And both were about 13, 14 minutes long, and featuring great improvisation from Buddy DeFranco, Vince Guaraldi, and Cal himself. And I think even Al McKibben, the bass player, got into the act as well. And then they had a Latin jazz finale when Mongo and Willie joined, and they played Cubano chant and tumbao. So that really wowed the audience. And the critic John Tynan, who was covering it for Downbeat. And that day, that Saturday, was the best, as far as the money they were taking, and that was the best day they had. Overall, they only made a slim profit, but it really showed people, that the Bay Area could put on, actually the Monterey Bay Area, I should say, could put on a great jazz festival. And the following year, Lyons wanted to make sure that he got a greater profit margin. And so he did another preview concert again with Cal and in April, and that was held at the Carmel Sunset School Auditorium. And that's where Cal's two albums, Concert by the Sea, Volume 1 and 2, came from. And a lot of people are familiar with those records. And they were really seminal records for Cal, because it really gave you an idea of what he offered, the cool swinging jazz, his wonderful ballad touch, and the Cuban influence.
Talk about Cal Jader's development throughout the 60s. Again, there are allusions in your book about, this was kind of the beginnings of rock and roll, where the market was starting to change. San Francisco was starting to change, North Beach. You had folk singers who were gaining popularity. Where did Cal's music go in that decade of the 60s?
Well, initially, like in 1960, Cal was interviewed, and Cal was not a big rock and roll guy initially. In fact, he said in an interview in 1960, he thought it would pass.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, of course, it didn't. But as time went on, Cal, like other jazz musicians, in order to survive, he adapted. And Cal was very good at adapting to whatever the musical trends were at the time without losing his integrity. He still maintained his artistic integrity and what he wanted to offer, but he would incorporate whatever the current sounds were. And so that's what he eventually in 1968 decided to go electric, in the sense that he got an electric bass player, Jim McCabe, and also Al Zuleika, who was his piano player, starting in 1965, initially on acoustic. He had Al go electric, so he was playing the electric piano, and Cal made that transition there. And he actually did quite well with it for someone that was initially reluctant, you know, to incorporate that sound. He still maintained, you know, what he wanted to do, but added what was going on at the time, which was the electric sound was more popular because of rock and roll. Yeah.
Talk a little bit about his qualities as a musician and a band leader. I know in the interviews throughout your book, there's a pretty good uniformity of what people said about working with him and what they got from him and what he gave to them.
Right. Well, the thing that, as a band leader, the thing that he offered was, when you came in, he expected professionalism and musicianship, but he was willing to listen to the ideas of the sidemen. That was important. He was willing to collaborate with them. It didn't mean he would use all your ideas, but he was willing to listen to them. And I think the sidemen really appreciated that. They also appreciated that he was very direct. He was a perfectionist, but not of the real demanding, you know, yell at you on stage kind. He didn't believe in doing that. He would talk to people about, you know, what his arrangements were and what he wanted. And so the sidemen knew what Cal wanted. Cal was very clear about the sound that he wanted, the harmonics and everything. And so, but he was also very open to listening, as I mentioned. And another thing the sidemen appreciated was that he gave them space to solo, you know, particularly when they were playing in live, you know, concerts and club dates. They really appreciated the fact that Cal was secure enough in his own abilities that he was not worried about whether they were going to take over the band because they, you know, soloed and wowed the audience. Cal enjoyed seeing his sidemen have success. And I think they really appreciated that. And that, of course, led to their own success in many cases after leaving the group because they were allowed to blossom. You know, some examples, of course, you know, on the Cuban side would be, you know, Mongo Santa Maria, who said that, you know, in 7 years with Tito Puente, you know, he didn't get that opportunity to really showcase himself. He, of course, was in the orchestra, and Tito, he said, took most of the solos and didn't really want to feature, you know, people like Mongo, who he knew, who he thought would upstage him and so forth. But Cal was not worried about that. He featured Mongo a lot and Willie Bobo on timbales, and they both really blossomed under Cal. In fact, Mongo said, "I learned more in a year from Cal than 7 years with Tito Puente." And later on, after they left Cal, they both became successful band leaders. And I think that's an example. Also, Michael Wolff, who played with Cal in the 70s, a young jazz piano player, same thing. Cal allowed him to do his thing, and he gained confidence and then went on eventually to become a leader. So I think that quality of nurturing his sidemen, their talent, and wanting to feature them, I think really was probably the best quality that that he had to offer as a band leader, that and his ability to listen. As far as his musicianship, I think the qualities that people liked the most were his sense of time. He was always right on the money, right on the beat, all the time. People were just amazed, you know, that he rarely, you know, missed a beat. You know, Poncho talked about that. He said, "Do you ever play a wrong note?" He said to Cal. Cal said, "Yeah, I do, but I cover it up pretty well."
Yeah.
But you wouldn't notice it, you know what I mean? And also his ability to play a ballad, his, you know, the way he could render a beautiful melody and enrich it with his own, his own harmonies. He was very inventive that way. He could always add his own touches to, you know, the theme of any song. And his introductions to the songs, he would often come up with himself. And there's just this beautiful sense of harmony and his wonderful, wonderful way that he was attuned to the melody. And just if you listen to his playing, also the nuances, just the little touches that you don't often hear from other vibists. Cal was a very subtle player. He didn't always believe in playing a lot of notes. He was very judicious about that, and that's another thing that was appreciated by his sidemen. They really enjoyed that quality. Cal's expression was breathe. So he believed in little moments of pausing and silence where you build anticipation as you're creating the music. And also in playing delicately when necessary. That's why he became such a great balladeer, is he just had this wonderful, delicate touch all the way up and down, you know, the scale. To me, that's what I really loved about him, you know, along with his, of course, his great time.
Maybe it was that early tap dancing experience, you know, where you're it's moving from the ground up through your whole body, you know.
Yes, exactly. In fact, Cal mentioned that in a 1953 interview with Ralph Gleason, that was really where he got his rhythm, being a tap dancer.
Yeah, from the ground up. That's interesting.
Yeah,
it's not from the mallets down, but it was from the ground up. Yeah, that's great. I always felt that way when I heard him play ballads, too. A lot of those Brazilian songs that he did his own interpretation.
Oh, right, yeah, like Mano de Carnaval, yeah.
Yeah, just really, yeah. Really lovely. And you mentioned, too, in the book that he was one of the first to, actually in a small group setting, to Latinize standards or even popular tunes, that he was very good at doing that, at arranging them to sound as if they were Latinized.
Yeah, yeah. He just really, see, that goes to his ear, you know, which, you know, that's another thing. You can't learn that. He just had this incredible ear. And he knew which jazz standards, you know, and Broadway tunes, whatever they might be that are in the jazz canon, he just knew which ones would work. You know, by putting a Cuban arrangement on it, you know, adding the Cuban rhythms. He just had a knack for that. And also, when he would play mambo tunes, like, for instance, Tito Puente's Philadelphia Mambo, he knew which tunes of that nature would work well with a jazzy feeling in them. So he would do it both ways. He really had a knack for that, and he really popularized that. And, I think, you know, his methodology, I think a lot of people followed that afterwards. He really was he wasn't the first one to do it, but certainly he really popularized that and became very adept at it. And people looked at the way he adapted those tunes.
You mentioned in talking before that, you know, Cal Jader was a pretty modest guy and a very open to collaboration and wasn't worried about being upstaged. There weren't a lot of allusions in your book about himself feeling about his own legacy, for example. And that seemed to be a strain that in your subtitle, for example, you said the life and recordings of the man who revolutionized Latin jazz. And you don't often hear Cal Jader's name mentioned as somebody who revolutionized Latin jazz. He wasn't really a self-promoter, was he?
Not really. I mean, of course, he put himself out there and he played gigs and he toured all over the United States and even out of the country on occasion. So, but yes, he, in terms of like doing, he would do interviews, but he always was very conscious of not wanting to appear egotistical or to, you know, blow his own horn. And so, and naturally he probably was a humble person, but I think there was a real consciousness of not, because he didn't like that in other musicians. He didn't like if they became too egoistic. And, but I think, you know, in the long run, it would have helped him if he had said something. And I know he was very intelligent and articulate in his interviews. He had a wide variety of interests in art as well as music, literature. But I think if he had just occasionally mentioned what he was doing a little more, I think people would have noticed. You know, I think people like Dave Brubeck spoke more about what they were doing, and I think that really helped them. So, yeah, I would agree with that.
Mm-hmm. You don't talk a lot about his personal life, but being on the road and just kind of the nature of being on the road all the time, his family life wasn't easy, particularly for his children. Definitely had an alcohol problem. What was that like in talking to his kids about having a father that was a musician and was on the road? Maybe that's the only father they ever knew, so that's what they grew up with. But certainly not a conventional lifestyle.
No, not at all. And it was very difficult, particularly when they were young. The daughter was Elizabeth Jader was particularly close to her father. So, you know, when she was a young girl, she would cry every time he left. And he would leave and he'd be gone for 2 weeks, even a month at a time. You know, then he'd come back and he'd be gone again. That was very difficult on the family. And and on the marriage, too. I wasn't able to talk to Pat Jader because she died just about 5 months before I started the book. But Liz does discuss that it did put a strain on the marriage because, you know, of course, his wife had to take care of the kids while he was gone and was saddled with that responsibility a lot of the time. Even though she did say that Cal was a good dad when he was around and, really had a connection with kids in general, with the neighborhood kids, and was very playful and would tell stories. But yes, it was very difficult with the family. And of course his drinking, which started early on, was very hard on the family. And, you know, as I mentioned in the book, of course, there were groupies. And when you're on the road for a long period of time, Cal was not someone one would think of as a ladies' man necessarily, but, you know, female fans were there and he was on the road. So that tends to happen. It's hard to resist it when it's so available. And so that put a strain on the marriage too. Liz told me that they would argue about that. Yes, it was difficult on the family. There's not much on the personal side of things, simply because I wasn't able to talk to the mother, who was reluctant, I heard, to talk about that anyway. So I may not have, even if she had been alive, I may not have been able to get into it so much. So I mainly had to talk to the kids. And so there is a gap as far as what went on in the early marriage. That as far as what happened later on, that kind of sums it up. Liz did get involved with her dad's touring when she when she was in college, and then after she graduated, she did go on some tours with him, got to know the musicians, was, very much a part of that, and he was welcoming to her. the son Rob was offered by Cal to be a roadie, but he wasn't really interested. He kind of was having some trials and tribulations as an adolescent himself.
You know, I remember an anecdote in our family. Duncan, my grandfather told this story that he was in sales and he wanted to get into vaudeville in the 20s. And he was on a park bench and he was talking to Ed Wynn, the old vaudevillian. And Ed Wynn was going, well, this is back in the late 1920s. He goes, well, vaudeville's on its way out and the movies are going to replace on that. And besides, you're on the road all the time and you're drinking constantly and all kinds of women. And my grandfather said, that's exactly the kind of life I'm looking for. But
yeah,
in any case, as a non-musician, you know, growing up, I always kind of envied and probably romanticized that life on the road. But you know, the more biographies you read, you know, it's a hard life.
It's a very difficult
life. And you don't get enough sleep, and you sure don't make the money that you're led to believe. Maybe if you're a rock star, but it was a tough life for jazz musicians in the 50s and 60s.
You're right. It was very difficult. There were a few exceptions, of course, those that really made it big. And and Cal did have his hit Soul Sauce, and he had his best year in 1965 financially, where, I think he sold well over 100,000 copies of that record. And that was his biggest hit, his signature song. And the album itself was a huge hit. And so he did make a fair amount of money that year, but yeah, you're right. Even so, in general, he wasn't like raking it in every year throughout his career, but he did make a good, I would say, middle class to upper middle class living, and lived in Millbrae, a suburb south of San Francisco. So he was able to provide well for his family and have a good standard of living. But it was a hard life. He wasn't always playing in prestigious venues necessarily. And, but he always managed to do a combination of concerts. He would play for really large audiences and, like at the Monterey Festival, play in front of 7,000 people, and then, or at Madison Square Garden in front of, even more people, and then also play in clubs in front of 100 or 200 people in a more intimate setting. And he would always sell out the clubs because he became a name. People were familiar with him, and he had such a large following. People would be waiting around the block, whether it be at the Blackhawk or the El Matador or, in Redondo Beach at concerts by the sea or the Lighthouse in Hermosa Beach. He always packed the club, Shelley's Manholm, also in Hollywood. But yeah, it was staying in the hotels and then, of course, jamming with other musicians. That was, what you did. And although Cal didn't always participate in the jams, according to Al Torrey in the 50s, but he did on occasion throughout his career. And of course, that will take you up into the night as well. It becomes convivial and guys hang out and then you play and then you want to go to a club. And like Herb Wong, the noted jazz historian who unfortunately recently died, he was living in Menlo Park. He was a great friend of Cal's. And they, as I note in the book, he would see Cal's gigs at the El Matador. And then after Cal was done, and this would be at night, they would, just bop from club to club, the Jazz Workshop, Basin Street West, along Broadway. And so Cal would be up all night.
Yeah.
You're right. Even when he was at home, he was just up into the wee hours and not getting a lot of sleep. Yeah.
If you were, say, teaching a short course on Cal Jader, do you have a suggestion, kind of a top five or a top three hit list that would give the depth and breadth of his playing? Maybe if you've never even heard of Cal Jader, is there an album you would go to say, this is one that will give you a taste of what this guy's all about?
Well, certainly for Cal's 50s sound, it depends on what era in his career, but for his 50s sound, I would say there's a CD called Monterey Concerts, which has both of the records that he did from that Carmel concert in 1959, which was Concert by the Sea, Volume 1 and 2. And that really, I think, in a nutshell, captures what he did in the 50s, which is my favorite part of Cal's career. And the thing I love is that it has a mixture of the things that Cal liked. Cal wasn't he's more famous for being a pioneer in Latin jazz, but he also was a wonderful straight-ahead player, had a great swinging sound, and all the qualities that he brought to Latin jazz, he also brought to straight ahead jazz, his great harmonic sense and his great time and just, wonderful sense of swing. And so that, I think that record encapsulates that. And also in 2008, the Monterey Jazz Festival label released that 58 concert that I alluded to earlier in Monterey, the first one with Buddy DeFranco. And that is a wonderful concert that in its entirety is featured on that record, and also various live performances that Cal did throughout his career at Monterey. It's called The Best of Cal Jader at the Monterey Jazz Festival, 1958 to 1980. And I think those are two, and there's, of course, quite a few in his Earth period. I would recommend, of course, Getting Soul Sauce. That's a wonderful album. And Several Shades of Jade, which he did with the great arranger and composer Lalo Schifrin. It's a wonderful big band jazz record with a little kind of Asian touch to it. He used some Oriental scales. Lalo Schifrin had studied musicology. And Creed Taylor, Cal's producer at Verve at the time, had suggested, that he try that sound. And so Cal went with it, and it's a wonderful big band album. And Cal really loved Schifrin's arrangements. And I think that's a great one from that period. And, of course, later in his career, when he was with Concord, L'Homme de Va Bien, the Grammy winner, I'd recommend that. And there's an obscure album that Cal did in 1958 called San Francisco Moods. And I talk at length about that album in the book. It's all original material. And the material is inspired by various places in San Francisco. Cal wrote some of the tunes, and so did Jack Weeks, who played bass on one of the selections. Jack wrote a tune called The Grand Avenue Suite, which is a series of vignettes. It's a real jazz tour de force, that song, and the whole album, for that matter. Eddie Duran is on that album, John Mosher playing bass, and John Markham on drums, all Bay Area stalwarts who contribute songs on that album. And it's a wonderful jazz album. There are jazz waltzes, there are bluesy tunes, swinging tunes. I mean, it's a wonderful 50s, jazz record. I would highly recommend that. You can get that on a CD titled Sentimental Moods, which also includes another record Cal did during that period called Latin for Lovers, which is more of a mood music, features ballads. Many, like Skylark, for instance, and Alone Together with the Cuban percussion of Lobo and Santa Maria. and the piano playing of Vince Guaraldi. So I would recommend those things to start off with.
That's great. That Several Shades of Jade, I must have played that 1,000 times, and I can remember driving through the desert at about 90 miles an hour with that blasting. It was, I think it was like Ginza Blues or something like that. It was fantastic.
The Tokyo Blues.
It was fantastic.
Yeah. That's a wonderful really arrangement. One. Yeah, wonderful arrangements on that. And on the musicianship, you know, Cal and the band that Schifrin assembled, you know, with Ernie Royal and Clark Terry and guys like that. Yeah, it's just it's a classic record.
Well, Duncan, we've taken up a lot of your time, but I could actually talk to you for a couple more hours because I saw Cal Jader a couple times and really loved his music. And I think I told you in an email, my mom used to take ballroom dancing lessons at his parents' studio there in San Mateo.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
So my connections with Cal Jader and the Bay Area jazz scenes go way back. You'd mentioned in an email to me that you were taking a break from lengthy projects, having read your book that was quite a project. Are you doing anything right now? Any special projects or any books or any articles now?
Yes. Well, I wrote an article about alto saxophonist John Handy and his collaboration with Ali Akbar Khan, a sarod player from East India. And I'm trying to find a publication that will accept it. It's hard right now, but hopefully I can get that published. Also, I'm working on a revised and expanded edition of my Jader biography. There's a lot of material that I've compiled that was not in the book, since I've published it. There's some things that didn't get into the book initially, and then other things that I've been working on. For instance, I was able to, through Jader's family, talk to Philip Smith, who was a lifelong friend of Cal's, from a real early age all the way until he died. In fact, his daughter said they spoke every day. So he lives in San Rafael. I went over to talk to him, and he had a lot of wonderful stories. And I wanted to, throughout Cal's life, particularly in his childhood, but as an adult as well. And I wanted to include those stories. And I'm working on talking to some other sidemen that I didn't get a chance to talk to and expand on some of the things that I touched on in the book as well. So I'm working on that. And also I'm writing some fiction as well. I've always wanted to write short stories.
Well, I wish you good luck on that, Duncan, and I enjoyed the book very much. It's reliving a lot of my past through the music, and I enjoyed so much getting the backstories in the background. And I think anybody who's a jazz lover and wants to plug themselves back into an era, a bygone era, that's a fascinating one, after World War II, and Cal Jader died in 1982, right? And he was
only
56 years old. So he was a young man with an enormous body of work that really, really had a profound effect, I think, on getting many, many listeners from many walks of life to appreciate the sounds of jazz. So I think you did really great work there, Duncan, and I'm glad you did it. You honored a wonderful guy and a great musician. So I think we're better for having your book out there.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much. And I appreciate your interviewing me as well, Doc.
Well, it's been a pleasure. The book, again, was Cal Jader, The Life and Recordings of the Man Who Revolutionized Latin Jazz. The author was S. Duncan Reed. The book was published by McFarlane Press, 2013. For New Books in Jazz, this is Doc Stoll.
You've been listening to New Books in Jazz with Doc Stoll. Our guest today was Duncan Reed, who spoke about his new book, Cal Jader, Life and Recordings of the Man Who Revolutionized Latin Jazz, published by McFarland & Company, Incorporated, 2013. For New Books in Jazz on the New Books Network, this is Doc Stull.